Gordon Brown says he wants to show international leadership on climate change. Gordon Brown says he wants to deliver a low-carbon UK. Gordon Brown says he wants to generate a green renewable energy revolution. Those are all excellent top-line objectives. If you wanted to identify one act which would undermine all of them, it would be consenting King's North.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the syndicated community radio programme that's part of the global movement for a safe climate. Gordon Brown's credibility is currently in the balance, whilst his Department for Business hovers on the verge of a decision that represents a make or break point for the climate. This is not my own assessment, but that of one of the world's leading climate scientists, James Hansen. Hansen, the head of NASA, took the unusual step of writing to the UK Prime Minister in a personal capacity back in December 2007, imploring him to take a leadership role in putting a moratorium on unabated new coal-fired power stations. The Prime Minister, he suggested, was in a unique position to precipitate a tipping point in the global response to climate change. Later in the programme, we get the story on the impressive rollback of planned new coal stations in the United States. In 2007, 59 were cancelled, abandoned or put on hold. Lester R. Brown has suggested that one way or another, the country is fast moving towards a moratorium on coal-fired electricity generating plants. But first, we continue our critical look at the compromise position that the Department for Business seems to be moving toward with regard to giving the go-ahead to new coal-fired power stations in this country. I spoke to Keith Allott, head of climate change at the World Wildlife Fund in the UK, to chew over why giving coal-fired power stations the go-ahead if they are carbon capture ready just isn't good enough. The draft planning conditions for King's North that were released to Greenpeace under the Freedom of Information back in January didn't require King's North to have carbon capture and storage as a condition. Has that changed, or is that still the case, do you know?
As far as you know, that's still the case.
So is it possible that John Hutton might give the go-ahead to the plant later this year but make it conditional on the plant being so-called carbon capture ready?
That certainly appears to be the way things are heading. The government is currently in the middle of a consultation on carbon capture readiness and what that means and what conditions might be attached to a consent which would be related to carbon capture readiness.
I mean, that potentially could lock us into inefficient high carbon generation until 2020, is that right?
Until 2020 or well beyond that date. I mean, I think the real concern here is that we appear to be rushing towards building one and then probably several more new coal-fired power stations under the promise that this new carbon capture technology will come along and sort it all out at some point in the future. There are no guarantees here at all, and even those who think that carbon capture and storage may prove to be a promising part of the solution towards climate change need to be convinced that the technology works and is not prohibitively costly before we take such a gamble with the atmosphere.
You commissioned a study into this concept of carbon capture readiness.
Sure.
It sounds like you didn't come away from that feeling confident that allowing new coal-fired power stations to go ahead on that condition would be an acceptable way ahead.
Well, we think it's actually a very naive approach towards consenting new power capacity. There's a lovely quote from an American environmentalist who says, if that coal-fired power station is carbon capture ready, then my driveway is Ferrari ready. There's no guarantee that you're ever going to have this fancy, shiny bit of kit parked beside the power station and fully operational. The reality is that carbon capture, while it may well have a useful role to play in the future towards helping the world achieve the radical reductions in carbon emissions that are necessary, the technology has not been demonstrated on a large scale on a complicated integrated power plant such as King's North anywhere in the world. So the priority needs to be to make sure we do not build any new coal stations, especially in developed countries like the UK, which don't have carbon capture, and then to have a parallel and entirely separate process to try and accelerate the development of carbon capture technology to find out if it works. But that shouldn't be at the expense of all the work that needs to go into driving forward renewables and energy efficiency. The government is currently mixing up its objectives. It looks as though it's heading towards giving the green light for Kings North under a thin veneer of greenwash, saying that Kings North may well be the site of a demonstration project for carbon capture. The problem with that is that even if Kings North does win this competition that the government has set up to have a small-scale demonstration plant for carbon capture, that plant would capture less than 20% of the station's emissions at best, and probably a lot less than that. That's a fig leaf.
I think the EU have a target of a certain number of demonstration projects by 2015. I mean, they'd be small-scale demonstration projects, and after that, but there'd be some monitoring, a few years of monitoring, before they'd be rolled out on a kind of commercial scale. So it's 2020, really, we're looking at before this technology would start to be commercially viable and viable on a large scale.
I think that's probably realistic. There is a question as to whether or not you could bring forward that timescale if you had a really smart, well-worked-out demonstration program going around Europe, indeed globally, to try and bring this forward. If you certainly believe the warnings from the scientists such as James Hansen, then I think this is an emergency. We need to be really accelerating the pace at which renewable energies can be rolled out, but also those that aren't quite at market stage yet be accelerated and brought to market stage. But frankly, if carbon capture and storage is going to be a contender, we need to find out sooner rather than later. And I think governments need to be, and companies need to be, putting some serious money into this as alongside the work on renewables.
So what did your report find in terms of the technical feasibility? Is it looking realistic?
There are a lot of complexities to getting carbon capture and storage to work. It's often talked about as a sort of sticking plaster that can be attached later on in the day, but it's pretty complicated stuff. You need to extract CO2 from the exhaust gases from a power station, especially if you do that in a conventional-style power station. You've got to take out the carbon dioxide from a quite dilute gas in the stream of flue gases in the chimney. That's quite a complicated process in itself. Then you have to have a pipeline, probably several hundred miles long, which will require all sorts of planning consents and concerns, to take that carbon, once you've captured it, and pipe it to a storage site. You have to identify a storage site. You have to have consents for the storage site. You have to be sure that the geology of the storage site, which would probably be under the North Sea, is secure and safe and would not lead to leakage. And then you have to have all the monitoring in place to make sure that that site will work. You have to have different companies involved at every stage of that chain. You have to have reliability. What happens if the carbon leaks, either from the pipe or from the storage site? There's a whole series of things that have never been done before at such a large scale. So our fundamental point of view is that actually going ahead and building power stations now and pretending that everything will be sorted in a few years' time is very naive.
I've heard people starting to say, probably industry people, that a campaign against coal would kind of hurt the progress of developing carbon capture and storage. What do you make of that charge?
I think it's a straw man. I think that a campaign against unabated coal is one thing. They're deliberately mixing up two things. Most environmental groups are actually supportive of the idea of finding out more about carbon capture and storage and accelerating our learning on this, whether it does have a role, if so, under what conditions, how much costly is it going to be, all of these questions. I think we need answers to those, but we shouldn't be mixing that up with a commercial imperative where a company like E.ON just wants to build its coal-fired power station to make lots of money out of it and then find a way of greenwashing it afterwards.
Perhaps you could also argue that if CCS was mandatory, then that actually might incentivise bringing forward CCS.
Well, indeed, and that's exactly our point of view. We are currently, and other groups are pushing very strongly, the idea of a greenhouse gas performance standard, both in the UK Energy Bill, but also through various directives that are currently going through Brussels. This policy will be based upon the same policy which is currently in force in California, where there's a simple rule saying that, know what we know about climate change, if you want to build any new power capacity, then it can't emit more than a certain quantity of CO2 per kilowatt hour. This policy has been supported by David Cameron in a speech in June. It's also supported by the Liberal Democrats, and we welcome that and recognition that this is the sort of policy we need to be driving forward low-carbon technologies by saying no to the dirty, polluting technologies.
I understand that Washington has also taken up California's lead and written it into their legislation as well.
That's right, yes. Things are moving very rapidly around the world on this, and I think on this issue, if you're looking for leadership, then despite some of the fine words that the UK government likes to say, on coal, we're not showing leadership. We are trying to leave everything to the market and market forces, and that's going to take us nowhere.
What are the benefits of that approach, the efficiency standard, over just an outright moratorium on new coal without carbon capture and storage?
There are a lot of commonalities, actually. They're not that different in terms of their impact. But I think the idea of having a legal instrument means that it would actually have some staying power. We have had, in the past, various moratoria introduced on different technologies. So I think about 8 or 9 years ago, the Labour government introduced a moratorium on gas-fired power stations without full heat recovery. And that was actually a policy designed to prop up the UK coal industry at the time. The Labour government introduced a moratorium on gas-fired power stations. Now, the problem with that was that it didn't stick, and it gradually moved away from it over the course of a year, and then it started consenting them again. So if you have a moratorium, that would have the same effect, but it would be a rather short-term fix, which could be changed very rapidly due to the changing political circumstances or some political pressure at the time from a particular lobby. Having a greenhouse gas standard would be technology neutral. It wouldn't be seen to be picking on coal. It would just be saying that this is a clear line in the sand, that this is the standard that a new coal station would have to meet. It would have to fit carbon capture to a certain level to meet the standard.
We do seem to be at a bit of a crossroads in terms of our electricity production in this country. We've got a so-called energy gap coming up with nuclear power coming offline, and coal plants as well, which don't meet the EU large combustion plant directive, are going to have to come off as well. So by 2015, there's this concern that perhaps we might have an energy gap, but at the same time, we have this commitment under the EU to produce 15% of our energy needs from renewables by 2020. Is that going to fill the gap?
Well, clearly, we are going to be losing a lot of our old nuclear power stations and quite a lot of our old coal-fired power stations. I mean, frankly, from an environmental point of view, that's very welcome. It's also very welcome that the government has finally said that it's going to go for and implement this EU target. It's a binding target. Tony Blair signed up to it. We've then had a lot of backsliding on it, but Gordon Brown has now made clear that the UK does want to deliver its fair share of the renewable energy target. There is still some attempts to wriggle out of this in the detail, but the big picture is that the government is broadly doing the right thing on renewables. It needs to stop looking for loopholes and just get on and implement it urgently. If we do meet the EU renewable energy target, and if we have some sensible and good cost-effective policies on energy efficiency, which will actually save us money, then it will mean that we can keep the lights on. To meet this target for renewable energy, which is 15% of all the UK's energy coming from renewables, now that means much more of our electricity than that will have to come from renewables, probably something like 35 or 40% by 2020. If that happens, they'll plug up that energy gap basically completely. There may be a need for a little bit of standby capacity for those few days of the year where the wind maybe doesn't blow as reliably as it does for most of the year. A small amount of extra gas capacity may be needed, but equally our initial look at this suggests that even that may not be needed at all. The renewables can fill the gap.
So the recommendations that came out of your report, you ended up turning that into a joint statement from the environmental NGOs, saying that it is unacceptable to build new unabated coal-fired power stations in the UK and making a number of specific recommendations.
Yeah.
How wide now is the campaign against coal beyond the environmental group? Is it extending to kind of development groups as well?
Sure. I mean, under the banner of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, which is a very broad-ranging coalition, there's now a much broader movement against unabated coal and in favour of strong domestic action to really try and show the leadership that's necessary on climate change. And the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition doesn't just include environmental groups, clearly people like WWF and Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth are prominent members, but also the whole development community, people such as Christian Aid and Oxfam World Development Movement are very important players, but also people from civil society, groups like the Women's Institute, the trade union movement, faith-based organisations, a whole range of different voices from civil society are standing up and saying that this is just simply not acceptable. We know enough already about the scale of the climate crisis and to be contemplating new unabated coal when we have the positive solutions within reach through renewables and energy efficiency is simply an act of folly.
Just how critical is this decision? I mean, if John Hutton gave the go-ahead to King's North, what would the ramifications of that be?
Well, I think the government and John Hutton like to portray this as being a minor technical discussion. The reality is that Gordon Brown says he wants to show international leadership on climate change. Gordon Brown says he wants to deliver a low-carbon UK. Gordon Brown says he wants to generate a green renewable energy revolution. Those are all excellent top-line objectives. If you wanted to identify one act which would undermine all of them, it would be consenting King's North. The reality is that it's not just about one power station. There are a series of other proposals for new coal-fired power stations waiting in the wings. And if King's North gets the green light, then, frankly, those other proposals will be coming forward pretty quickly as well. It's a green light for business as usual for the fossil fuel lobby, and that would have ramifications both in the UK, but also in Europe and internationally. The world's media does focus very strongly on what happens in the UK. If we fail to take this strong lead at home, then who are we in the UK to go onto the world stage and urge countries like China and India to do anything differently in terms of bending their curve of emissions away from the business-as-usual trajectory?
That was Keith Allott, head of the World Wildlife Fund's climate change campaign in the UK. The report mentioned in that interview is called Evading Capture and can be found on the WWF website. We asked the Department for Business for an interview so that we could put some of the points raised in that interview and by James Hansen's plea to Gordon Brown to them directly. We weren't granted an interview, but we were given a written statement instead, which said that they cannot comment on any specific live application, such as E.ON's King's North application. On the question of emissions and climate change, the department's defence is that power stations operate within the EU emissions trading scheme, but the effectiveness of that scheme is open to serious question. You can read our written questions and the department's full response at the Climate Radio Archive. It is interesting to note that the department has been mandated by the Prime Minister to be the voice of business across government, and that ensuring business plays its fair role in helping avoid dangerous climate change is not one of the department's priorities. And today we read on the front page of the Guardian newspaper that the UK is trying to weaken down EU legislation on renewable energy yet again. Our green leadership seems to be slipping faster than you can say vested interests. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, Canada ruled out unabated coal-fired stations back in March. And even in the United States, the tide is rapidly turning against unabated coal at the grassroots state and federal levels. I spoke to Mike Yule from the Energy Justice Network in Pennsylvania, who is helping to link up community campaigns across the country.
I'm fascinated to hear about what's happening in the states. The amount of rollback that there seems to have been on the amount of planned coal-fired generation seems pretty impressive. Is it 59 were cancelled last year?
Yep.
Out of what, 150?
The official count is around 150 that our federal government keeps, but the industry's data tracking on it shows that the peak number of proposals was closer to around 250-some.
And on top of that, there's about 50 that are being contested in the courts?
I'm not sure the exact numbers on how many in the courts, but there are quite a number that are being contested that way, and plenty of other contesting that's being done at the local grassroots level.
There seems to be opposition and from all kinds of levels, varying from the kind of big environmental campaign groups down to attorney generals in the different states putting pressure on other states, and all kinds of local groups as well. The kind of 59 that were cancelled last year, how were they contested and what was the reason for those being successful?
Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons out there. Some of the reasons are just because the economics of things changing so much that the coal prices are shooting up dramatically, especially in the past several months. The longer-term trend of coal prices since 2000 has been going up quite a bit, to the point where they're around triple what they used to be just 8 years ago. So you have that combined with the increased costs in construction and all the construction materials that are a contributing factor to a lot of these cancellations. And so within that environment, we have nonprofit organizations that are suing over lobbies, that are delaying the permits, which means the cost goes up as permit fights are going on. We have local battles over land use and different methods that groups are using to contest things at the very local level. And every means to delay a plant is often a means that results in stopping it.
I mean, in terms of the economics, some of the projects that appear to have been falling in 2008, the cost estimates seem to have doubled in a very short period, and that seems to be pushing them back. And also, various banks are downgrading company coal stocks. Is that having an effect?
That's definitely having an effect. There's a very organized campaign coordinated primarily by the Rainforest Action Network that has been targeting a lot of these big banks that are funding a lot of these dirty energy projects, and particularly trying to get them to back off of coal investments. And that's been fairly successful. A number of the banks have reconsidered and started to adopt different policies on what their investments are going to look like. And just shaking up the whole financial community, which is already fairly well shaken up based on the rising cost of all these things and the uncertainty around global warming and how that could affect their investments, that's helping get a lot of these projects not to get the financing that they need.
I guess an incoming president might, well, actually both of the candidates have some form of cap and trade in their policies, is that right? So that would impact on the economics of coal-fired generation as well?
Yes, definitely.
Also, I was noting, I think it was Lester R. Brown was saying that some of the more progressive states, the attorney generals have been putting pressure on other states to try and convince them not to go ahead with coal stations, using the argument that it would cancel out their own efforts to try and reduce CO2.
Right. There is a lot of action at the state level to start to combat this. It's largely in response to the fact that the federal level has not been very responsive under President Bush. It also wasn't responsive prior to him under President Clinton. And what we're seeing, to get back to the presidential candidates, while there is more talk in both the Obama and McCain camps around doing something on global warming and backing off of some of their pro-coal positions, they're still very much in favor of what they call clean coal and putting federal money into these false solutions, which really are not an answer. They're not viable. They're not even a very good answer for climate change. And the types of climate change policies that they're talking about in terms of cap and trade and other carbon trading mechanisms, we know from the European experience and just in general that these are not effective ways to really reduce global warming emissions. So we have hopes that things will get better than they are, but not that much better under the two major party candidates for the president.
At the federal level, there's the bill introduced by Henry Waxman, which would effectively place a moratorium on new coal without CCS. Do you know if there's been any progress on that since he announced it in March, I think?
I'm not sure where that bill stands, but that is one of those types of half measures which says not to stop coal, but to stop only coal if it doesn't have this carbon sequestration scheme. And this carbon sequestration is so unproven, it's so expensive and inefficient, and it just makes no sense to really dump resources into that. And so even though the safe way to talk about the issue is say, well, we're against the old kind of coal, but not against the new kind of coal, really, we need to stop playing with coal altogether, because it still means taking our mountains apart in West Virginia. It still means a lot of damage. All it does to sequester carbon and use this gasification model means that you're taking some of the pollution out of the air and dumping it underground or into ash dumps that become more toxic. So it just moves the pollution from one place to another.
And also on the federal level, the ruling by the Supreme Court that the CO2 should be a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, Bush hasn't been enacting this. So again, would an incoming president feel mandated to do something about that?
It's really hard to say. We know from the experience with the Environmental Protection Agency on a number of other issues that it can take them 10 to 20 years to really even develop and enforce regulations on any topic. So I'm not having high hopes that there can be a timely response on that matter. It really depends on what kinds of specific legislation pass.
And going back to the Clean Air Act, the Sierra Club were threatening to sue companies for violation of the Clean Air Act. That was back in May. Did you hear anything else about that?
I haven't really been following the lawsuit elements of
okay.
It. Most of what we do is we work at the grassroots level and build networks with folks at the grassroots. So while lawsuits are part of that, the kind of tactics that Sierra Club and these larger groups are doing, that's not where we're as focused as much.
Okay. So maybe just tell us quickly about what you do. You're kind of basically acting as a hub or a network to put local campaigners in touch, and so they can kind of see what's been working in different states and kind of build on that.
Exactly. We work across a wide range of dirty energy and waste technologies. So we've been helping build grassroots networks of folks that are fighting coal plants, folks that are fighting ethanol biorefineries, incinerators of all sorts, including the biomass variety, which often big environmental groups still think are a good idea. And basically, by connecting these grassroots communities to each other, it brings their understanding of the world from a NIMBY stance, a not-in-my-backyard type of understanding, to a not-in-anyone's-backyard type of understanding. And in doing so, we find that these communities will support each other and help each other in their fights. And then instead of just having this impression that we're pushing dirty energy proposals from one community to another, but they still get built, the reality is that large proportions of these industries' plans are being shot down. And like we're seeing with the coal industry, and like we saw with the nuclear industry, with the trash incinerator industry, and with the natural gas building boom that's happened in the past few decades, that huge proportions from half of the industry's proposals up to close to 90% of the proposed facilities end up getting defeated, and it's mostly through one community at a time, grassroots type of organizing.
Wow. And is it more of a letter writing and appearing at public inquiries, that type of work, rather than direct actions that is kind of making the difference here?
It's actually a wide range of tactics. There are folks doing everything from lawsuits to letter writing to taking over the local governments in order to pass laws that their officials weren't willing to pass beforehand to doing direct action. We have folks that just got arrested in Ohio against one of the companies trying to build coal plants in a part of that state, which is the nation's worst cluster for existing and proposed coal power plants and other coal facilities. So there's everything from blocking trucks and getting arrested to legal processes going on.
I mean, is there anything else that you think is significant that I haven't kind of touched on that is making a difference there?
Well, one trend that's really important to spread the word about, because we still have this misinformation that goes around saying that we have 200 to 300 years of coal left in the U.S. and they call us the Saudi Arabia of coal. We do have the largest reserves of coal in the world. However, this impression that we have this endless supply is very much false. A lot of people are now familiar with this whole peak oil concept. Not as many are as familiar with peak natural gas, which is happening in North America right now and will be happening globally around 2020. But peak coal is also a lot sooner than people realize. In terms of energy production, we've actually peaked in 2002 in the U.S. And if you measure it in tonnage, because it looks like just measuring in tonnage, like our production is still going up, which it is, we're going to peak probably around 2030. Globally, the peak production of coal is supposed to be around 2025. So within the lifetime of when these power plants would be operating and be trying to be paid off, we're going to hit a point where coal prices skyrocket even more than they're already doing, and where it becomes so economically unviable that they're going to stop running the plants.
So are you confident that you can win against most of these proposed developments?
Absolutely. I think the trend in the past year has been a major crash in the viability of the proposed coal plants in the U.S., and I think that's just going to speed up, and we're going to see the finishing of that bell curve of proposals within the next year or two.
That was Mike Ewell of the Energy Justice Network in the U.S., which brings us to the end of today's program. References and links for the show can be found up on the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.co.uk, where you can also listen to today's show again, as well as any other programme from the archive. We're going to leave you today with more history. A week ago, on the 17th of July, Al Gore made a landmark speech where he suggested we should respond to climate change with the due urgency that the science now implies. He laid down a moon landing-style challenge to repower the US by renewable energy within just 10 years. Here's a taster.
So I ask you to join with me to call on every candidate at every level to accept this challenge for America to be running on 100% zero carbon electricity in 10 years. It's time for us to move beyond empty rhetoric. We need to act now, and we need to act boldly. This is a generational moment, a moment when we decide our own path and our collective fate. We must now lift our nation to reach another goal that will change history. Our entire civilization depends upon us now embarking on a new journey of exploration and discovery. Our success depends on our willingness as a people to undertake this journey and to complete it within 10 years. Once again, we have an opportunity to take a giant leap for humankind. Thank you for coming.